Hello and thanks for tuning in to this podcast. My name is Victor Lovén and I am an MA student in Communication for Development at Malmö University. Right now I'm in the middle of a course about new media, ICT and development, where me and some fellow students are blogging about new media, online activism and technology. New media and information and communication technologies have a massive impact on the development in different societies globally. We can't separate technology and society. Technology is society, and society is technology. Therefore, we must critically examine the professionals behind these technologies. They have a lot of power. As Sophia Noble writes, those who have the power to design have the ability to prioritize certain types of information over others. One of the key players in creating both the technology and its content is the designers. They have the power to foster some real change. So I wonder, why don't we see more responsible and sustainable design? And how much can we blame design education for all this? In this pod, I will discuss the power dynamics at play in design education and design practice, and how can we restructure these dynamics in order to move towards a more responsible and sustainable design. You will also hear some banter about the Enlightenment, an 18th century prison-turned-design studio, and also got a great question on this subject from one of my blog visitors, and we will try to get an answer on that. But this pod would be nothing without my guest Tove Martens. Hello and thank you for joining the pod.
Hello and thanks for inviting me.
You are a graphic designer and educator with over 10 years experience of running your own design studio, as well as being an acknowledged guest lecturer at Linnaeus University. And you are currently pursuing an MA in graphic design at Falmouth University.
All of that is true.
Thank you.
I'm really looking forward to discussing this topic. Where do you want to start?
Well, I thought we could start where our future designers are shaped. Let's start with A, as in academia, and A as in Arturo Escobar. According to him, academia is one of the four great institutions responsible for the unsustainability in the world. Much has to do with the corporatization of higher education in many countries in the last decades. Education has been turned into a commodity, and you have probably also noticed this.
I believe Escobar is right. So perhaps I can discuss this from three different perspectives. Mm-hmm. First of all, there are a lot of education programs where the focus is entirely on entrepreneurship, business schools, etc. And in, for example, design education, there's often an entrepreneurial ambition implemented in a course or in the culture of that education. So the purpose in the end is very often to make yourself or your design commercially viable. Mm. Secondly, in many countries, going to uni costs a lot of money. A diploma from one of the most renowned schools in Europe can cost a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot, which raises some questions on who can attend these schools. But it also creates an appropriate bridge to the third point of view.
Nice, nice.
So these educations that cost, there's also a question of making a profit, right?
Yeah.
And that can be regulated in how big an intake they have. What happens with the quality of the study environment then, and the teaching and the examination, etc., etc. In academia's defense, because I have to defend them, I would also like to say that there are developing a lot more sustainable approaches in education as well. And for example, the dean of OCAD University in Canada, Elizabeth Dory Tunstall, she's working to decolonize their institution.
Hmm.
And you know, that is an ambition that can easily be verbalized.
Sure.
But that sort of work, internally and externally, is huge. Huge!
Yeah.
And universities are large, inert animals, ecosystems in their own. But that does not mean that they are impossible to change.
No. I'm thinking of Anne-Marie Willis here. She has a design program at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh. And that program seeks to create a significant cultural shift towards sustainment. But she claims it can't be as revolutionary as it has to be.
Okay.
It is reformist, but not revolutionary.
Mm-hmm.
And she says that there is a problem in branding and marketing a radical postgraduate program intending to dismantle the system. and therefore, it has to be made less radical. Do you believe in this kind of self-censorship in creating educational programs?
As said before, universities are big, traditional, funded, mm-hmm. etc. And it can take and will and hard work to change even the small things. So I do believe that Swedish design education is closing in on themes as norm creativity, decolonizing design, working with feminist pedagogy to some extent. Perhaps educational programs are becoming more and more brave. Personally, I haven't tried to brand and market a radical program intending to dismantle the system yet.
Yeah. Maybe we have to start with creating revolutionary programs to dismantle the system.
Why not?
Maybe we could just start with any existing university program. I mean, in all university programs, teachers and professors decide on course readings, guest lecturers, learning outcomes. I mean, they have the privilege of deciding what knowledge is good enough to transfer to the students. And that privilege is perhaps something we should look deeper into. And I have to talk about Escobar again here, because he writes that most major universities prepare individuals to be successful and compete in market economies, thus carrying on with the unsustainability, according to him. And Noble writes that in most universities in the US, computer engineers lack knowledge in social sciences and humanities, and they are therefore underexposed to critical thinking and learning about history and culture. And now I'm finally coming to my question here, but this priority of free market success over critical thinking, is that perhaps also the case in design?
Well, to some extent, yes, I certainly think so. And I don't know if design education specifically attracts people that simply just want to create nice things,
yeah.
and therefore not read and understand the complexity of our culture and history.
Yeah.
I am ambivalent about this one, actually, because I actually do think both of these practitioners have to exist. The more practical one, if we can call it that, and the more critical one, they both fill a purpose.
Sure.
In an educational situation, there is an opportunity to widen your gaze and deepen your understanding. And perhaps at bachelor level, my experience is that this is usually less common, like the critical thinking, because you might be fresh out of high school, you're entering a new field, a new way of study, and so on. But in postgraduate programs, there is definitely an opportunity for a more investigative approach. And that sort of educational situation demands more of the student's ability of initiative. But it also requires a lot from the tutor's ability to facilitate a learning environment where this critical thinking is really encouraged.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. But I think the focus is more on creating these like specialized design entrepreneurs, and specialization kills critical thinking, if you would believe the intelligence researcher James Flynn. Even the best universities aren't developing critical intelligence. They don't give the students the tools to analyze the modern world, except in their little area of specialization, of course. And I also read the Jonathan Derbyshire of the Financial Times, he calls this the academia's cult of specialization. Is design education too narrow, you think? Is design academia also a cult of specialization? Are the conceptual reasoning skills among designers too bad?
I'm not sure I understand this. Can you narrow this question down ironically?
The question is, are you a cult leader?
I wish I was. But I lack any charisma for that sort of job or whatever calling, I'm afraid. But please explain this ill-concealed contempt for designers. You're coming at me.
No, I mean, okay. Is design education too focused on creating specialized design experts at the cost of conceptual reasoning skills?
I feel that perhaps I do not have the authority to answer that question, but why can't there be both?
Mm.
And to try to answer your question, my interpretation of design education in the context where I live and work, which is a small context if you compare it to the rest of the world, but my interpretation is that it varies a lot.
I realize that it probably varies a lot. What I think I'm trying to do here is to embark on some sort of crusade in the name of social sciences and humanities.
a hero of our time.
Yeah, Noble. She claims that the lack of diverse and critically minded workforce on issues of race and gender impacts the intellectual output, I mean the actual output of the work. So do you think more social sciences and humanities in design education, would that improve the quality of the design outcome?
Well, to some extent, sure, because we are designing for society, and society is part of our design process as well. So in many contexts, we need training and education of history, cultural studies, and we need knowledge about, for example, minorities and power struggles in order to create a truly great design. if you don't have knowledge about people and communities, the design may often exclude someone based on, for example, gender, race, or class.
Yeah, that is very true. But let me just go over here and perhaps take down the social sciences from the pedestal I quite uncritically put it on the last question. I was like, oh, humanities is so superior to engineering, technology, and math. We are rewriting the STEM subjects. We put social science and humanities in there, in the back. And we don't say STEM. We call it STEM-sh.
Okay.
And we have saved the world. No, I read something about, was it Linje Manioso, I think, in communicating development with communities, I think. He can perhaps save me here, because he writes that there are like thousands of degree programs, even in social sciences, where students read many books without understanding them. They don't critically engage with the like socio-political and economic reality. They complete their exams, they complete their assignments, they complete their research projects, but they never really reflect on what they are learning. And training to listen is certainly not part of these degree programs. So, Tove, I guess I guess you don't teach any specific courses in the art of listening, but does anything you teach relate in some way to listening and engaging critically with yeah, social, political, and economic reality.
Wow. Well, please note that I usually teach at bachelor's level, and in some courses I'm just helping students grasp the basics of design. In some cases, I'm just that person who brings paper and scissors for a session of the good old cut and paste. Mm. So, but sure, I want to believe that what you are asking for is inherent in analysis on target audiences, for example.
Mm.
So usually in the courses where I teach fully, there are projects involving designing for change. Mm. And sometimes students are specifically asked to use graphic design for social and cultural responsibility. So that is projects that require an analysis beyond design basics, perhaps.
Yeah. And that is great to hear. That is really important, I think. I mean, in order to design change, I think you need to be aware of all these different power relations in society and the history that formed them.
Mm.
The values and beliefs from the Enlightenment and the legacies of European colonialism, they have shaped design historically and are still highly present in contemporary design.
Many nice words there, Victor. I know.
Thank you.
I know the people from your field.
Oh yes.
Love to drag the Enlightenment, and sure, that was a time where most of the harmful ideas
yes,
of our
were.
Civilizations were constituted, but let's not undermine the complexity of that time either.
No.
Or did I just sound like that? There was an old man a few years back, and he wrote a really absurd column, and it had the headline was something like, "Was colonialism really that bad?" That is not at all what I'm talking about here.
Thank you.
I'm talking about the Enlightenment, and maybe I should have mentioned in the beginning, or you should have mentioned, that a huge part, actually the main focus of my practice is history.
Mm.
But I also get the feeling like you're trying to pick a fight with me now on whether the Enlightenment was essentially good or bad. Because if you want to, I'm up for that.
No, I won't pick a fight. And if we were to try to categorize the Enlightenment into was it good or was it bad, wouldn't that have been sort of a way to conform to Mr. Enlightenment's very own harmful binaries?
Just leave it.
Well, yes, I will leave it. What I want to say about the Enlightenment was about its dependency on these philosophies of reason and rationalism and the need to construct the other in order to be able to define the self.
Mm.
And these binary oppositions have shaped Western knowledge since then and still do today.
Mm.
And I mean, establishing the normal, normative good in contrast to the abnormal, deviant bad.
Mm.
That is also the foundation of the knowledge hierarchies, that we prioritize scientific knowledge over natural knowledge, that academic knowledge separates and disconnects from the other, the natural world. And all knowledge outside these conventional education is not real knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
Do you agree with this?
These are some very big questions in big contexts. And again, I feel unauthorized, but essentially I agree. And I think that is an interesting idea, and that it is possible that the academic knowledge would benefit from being less
hierarchical.
Obviously, I didn't pass English. Anyway, on the structural level, they would perhaps benefit from being less hierarchical. Oh my god! But what I wanted to say that in the structure, perhaps, but that can also be part of basic classroom work. like how does a tutor work with students in regards to different cultures and communities?
Yeah, I mean, we can definitely learn from other cultures outside the mainstream like monopoly of knowledge. And the tutor can definitely contribute to reducing these knowledge hierarchies by bringing these like other knowledges up to the surface. Or?
Yeah. That is very interesting. And as well, I recently read a very interesting book that proclaimed that British?
Did you say British?
No, it doesn't have to be. It could be from other countries, okay? Mm. But scholars, we can say scholars, they are responsible for translating and misinterpreting the Enuma Elish.
Enuma Elish?
Yeah, that is Babylonia's creation myth. So it's super old. It's on cuneiform tablets. Mm-hmm. So that basically means that the knowledge itself is many times colonized. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you probably knew that. But many people don't know that. And they don't know that many of our thought narratives are filtered through the harmful ideas deriving from, you know.
Sorry, from what age?
From just some time during the 18th century, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I was about to say that cross-connecting disciplines is to avoid in some academic fields, and I can absolutely understand why there's a purpose for that. But it can also be problematic every time a mainstream narrative is thought of as the only legitimate knowledge.
Mm.
So, because that means other possible narratives are subdued, yeah, right? So yeah, that can maybe also be an effective way to keep obsolete norms or constructed truths as the only ones.
Oh, yes. and it goes on and on. I mean, we inherited it from our ancestors, and I mean, these practices of creating one single almighty truth or one true knowledge, ignoring all other perspectives, and sadly, it's still highly present today, I think.
I absolutely agree, and this is why I think we sometimes need to confront our history.
Mm-hmm.
And this is actually something that I'm quite interested in as a graphic designer,
yeah,
to explore what happens when dividing that hegemonic knowledge and letting these different narratives through and letting them coexist. And perhaps that can be a way to reach more equality and mm-hmm. inclusion,
yeah,
maybe.
I totally agree. Many narratives must coexist. But is it possible? Universities are really tied to their cultures of expertise.
Yeah.
Escobar, you remember him? I mean, he writes that he's not sure that designers are able to break free from education to just, you know, drop that and start designing and learning within, for example, grassroots cultures instead. Mm-hmm. I mean, it might be very difficult. You know, conventional education has been dragging these cultures and their forms of knowledge and yeah. lives in the dirt for such long time.
Mm-hmm.
It's been totally devalued.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's that easy for conventional education to suddenly just start taking them seriously, which is sad. Conventional education is part of a civilization, I think, that has not treated the earth very well. And maybe the more earth-wise knowledge from other cultures is perhaps what is needed for humans and the earth to start functioning again. How much is the design education to blame for the contemporary unsustainability within design studios? According to Escobar, this pod's household name. Most design theory and practice never deal with questions of class, gender, race, and coloniality. Are designers simply not interested in these matters? Or has the education failed them? Tove?
Wow. Sad news, but perhaps a little bit of both.
Yeah.
Good news, though, is that I personally want to believe we are at a shift.
Mm-hmm.
I think that I can see that the next generation designers appear to be much more concerned than our generation, for example.
Mm.
And the one previous from ours couldn't care less. Maybe part of this problem is that graphic design in both practice and education has this old habit of navigating through design heroes.
Mm.
And they can be both contemporary and past ones. And then everyone is supposed to love them mm-hmm. unconditionally.
Yep.
And this is perhaps an absurd example, but I recently read an interview with one of our biggest design heroes. Like, everyone loves him. If you speak his name, everyone will scream.
Oh,
like,
really?
He's the best.
But we're not saying his name.
We are not saying his name. Because I don't want to get sued from him. And you'll soon understand why. Because he has this dream or whatever to build an architectural structure of his studio.
Mm-hmm.
And so far, so good.
Yeah.
And the thing is, I read about this in an interview with him, and they included the sketch of this studio mm-hmm. architectural structure. And when I saw that sketch, I was like, is that Jeremy Bentham's Panopticon? And the
charming
thing is, his argument for this as well was to be able to keep sight of his employees. And I have the quote here for you.
Thank you.
He said, I want people to know that if they are slackers or go to the toilet too many times or take 50 smoking breaks, there is some social control.
Whoa.
That's not fascism. That is simply good management.
Oh, wow. That's the management course 101.
But I guess reading that, I guess it was the freaking Panopticon.
Yeah.
And I think that, like, what I'm trying to say here is that someone who implements that sort of structure, that sort of thinking from our common favorite era.
Oh, the Enlightenment.
The Enlightenment. Into their design studio in the 21st century. Like, do you really expect someone like that? Or a context where everyone is looking up to this person to engage in questions of class, gender, race, and coloniality.
Mm-mm.
He does not have time for that because he's busy enough dreaming of his cultural studio. And that is definitely a bit too harsh with me. But it is also pretty outdated, reinstituting power structures from the 18th century to be... Bear.
Yeah, I mean, this is absurd.
Yeah,
I'm close to speechless here too. I mean, it's not really what I read in contemporary discourses about workplace environment.
Really,
trust-based leadership and employee satisfaction. Hey, can't work in our 18th century prison where we keep an eye on you every movement throughout the working day.
It's not fascism, it's good management.
Oh, mother, this is ridiculous. And I mean, yeah, I understand that if one of the design heroes has these views and values, many designers will follow, which is incredibly harmful for both the design industry, but also for society. So, to be a bit more serious here, why can't just design deal more with politics? Why not sit there in your panopticon cell and focus more on designing a better society, aiming to fight racism, fight misogyny, fight class inequalities? Why?
Well... considering my little rant is clearly about your own privileges, that to some extent needs to be evaluated and renounced in that process. And that can really be quite a shameful experience. But I also feel that is a bit of an unfair statement, because there is a lot of work being done in design to deal with this aspect. And perhaps this person does that as well. It's just well hidden behind his other thoughts. And educational programs to some extent as well.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we are just learning to unlearn some of the knowledge we perhaps didn't even know was even harmful to begin with.
Mm.
And I would actually like to quote Elizabeth Shin. I brought a quote from Views in Fiction to Explore Social Facts. She writes that there are few social spaces more unrelentingly white than the art and design studio.
Mm.
This unreflective whiteness in design territories is unable to excavate, or perhaps uninterested in excavating, the racist and sexist ideologies embedded in Bauhaus-derived aesthetics that constitute good designs for many.
Wow. That is one of the best quotes I heard in a long time. I mean, she goes after Bauhaus.
She does go after Bauhaus. But you know what? It is about time. And not only that, it's been about time for a long time. And it does not take a lot of research to uncover that there are several problematic aspects from just embracing the modernist era of graphic design.
Mm.
But it is also about the ethnocentric view.
The ethnocentric view. Yeah, I mean that is so problematic. I just read Andre Brock, and he kind of attacked the ethnocentrism within designers, as well within, was it content providers and policymakers, but designers also. And he said that they bring their racial frames to the internet experience.
Okay.
And they make the internet a representation of white, masculine, middle class, heterosexual Christian culture.
Mm.
And they simply recreate the same social dynamics, the same patterns of marginalizing women and people of color that is found offline.
Mm, yeah, okay. And perhaps these dynamics are even more invisible, sort of, online.
Mm, yeah.
Since they are then applied in, let's say, an algorithm or some other design tool that is proclaimed objective and user oriented.
Yes, but we must never, Tove, we must never forget that these algorithms and tools are created by human beings.
Okay.
And the racism and sexism is internalized within them. Anna Kumar writes that white supremacist culture is so powerful and we are so rewarded in so many ways for conforming to it that we are sometimes blind to its influence. As I mentioned in the beginning of the pod, I'm currently blogging.
Yeah.
Yeah. Me and a couple of my fellow students have created a blog called Decol Online. That's a good name. And after blogging about making this podcast, I received a comment from one of the readers, Lauren, and she has a great question, I think. While we read a lot about decolonizing systems design, AI, for example, I'm wondering what applications of this do you see for graphic or visual design? And how is this, or how isn't this, addressed in current education programs?
Wow, that is a great question.
Yeah.
It is also a big one, so I'm going to take my time with this one.
Yeah, go ahead.
First of all, I would like to again mention Elisabeth Dory Tunstall, who has formulated 8 principles of design anthropology as a decolonizing practice. And the reason I say her name over and over is because the meaning of a voice like hers in her position, and just someone who takes the time to encapsulate big themes in accessible educational concepts, is extremely valuable.
Yeah.
It means everything, basically.
Yeah. Yeah.
In education programs for design, my very subjective opinion, from probably a narrow perspective as well, you know, is that it is not nearly enough addressed.
Mm.
And I think some of the things we have been talking about previously underlines that fact.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
And perhaps the problem is that the knowledge itself needs to be decolonized,
mm-hmm.
as I said earlier,
yeah.
as well.
Yeah.
I mentioned earlier that the design history is to some extent taught through design heroes.
Yeah.
And these are usually white men in the West.
Mm.
And we design from a set of values established in, for example, Germany and Switzerland during the 1930s and 50s. So it's almost like it works like a Western belief system on what good and objective design is.
Mm.
While we consider work from the Global South as craft rather than design.
Oh, yeah.
Deeming them and their work inferior.
Yeah.
And you know what? Enlightenment lovers of the world.
Here we go again.
That is a false dichotomy right
yeah.
there. Craft and design.
I was just about to say that.
Really? So I actually also read in an article where educator and designer Dana Abdullah said that decoloniality is about reimagining something that is beyond the current system we exist in.
Mm-hmm.
And in many contexts and education programs, I believe that not only is that possible, but I also think that it is currently in progress.
Mm.
And while in other education programs,
mm.
that is not even a concern
mm.
or rather, the knowledge about what decoloniality encompasses is very limited.
Mm. It varies a lot.
It varies a lot.
It varies a lot, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was interesting. And it made me think of something here. Instead of teaching these white male designers how to listen to others, maybe we should just let others design more.
Mm-hmm.
Apart from this great question that Lauren asked, she also made me aware of a website called Feminist Principles of the Internet. You can find it at feministinternet.org. They write that women must not merely be users of the internet, but also producers. They need to be coders, designers, bloggers, creators. And that will do a lot of good and maybe help us get the white male designers to start listen, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, but I also think that these clear gendered barriers that they talk about,
mm-hmm.
they can easily be translated into barriers of race, class, or any other like marginalized group. I mean, we definitely need more diversity among producers, since many of the new media and information and communication technologies are operating worldwide. All parts of the world should be represented in their workforces of coders, designers, bloggers, and creators.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And I was thinking about, just to connect back to what you said earlier, because
mm-hmm.
that website, Feminist Internet,
mm?
You sent that to me before we recorded this, and
mm.
I had a look at it, and that is basically one of the many applications of something that I have made up this name, but I call it educational scenes.
Mm-hmm.
They're like educational platforms outside of academia, often pushing for change. And they're so incredibly important.
Mm.
And I thought of another one called futurist.org.
Mm-hmm.
And they are providing different narratives that usually might be ignored, as we've discussed before.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that maybe, perhaps, instead of trying to make the universe more diverse, should we try to divide the universal world into smaller worlds that can coexist?
Oh, yes. Yes. the universality of the Western platform capitalists, these corporate superpowers, is not sustainable. And there are reactions to this new digital Western imperialism around the world.
Let me just go back to the grand old man, Arturo Escobar. He writes that design is so very dependent on capitalism, but that most design theory and practice don't deal with this dependency. And I find it quite problematic that design is such a big part of advertising and also so greatly dependent on advertising, especially when realizing how ignorant and socially irresponsible many design studios are. And Nobles stresses that the power advertising has in shaping culture and society, that the stereotypical depictions of women and minorities in advertising impact the behavior of those who consume it.
Yeah, it really does. Stereotypical depictions normalize behaviors that are deeply harmful for us as a society. And deconstructing women's bodies, infantilizing women, or sexualizing children, what does the normalization of such images tell us? But in the world of advertising, creating a message where you romanticize domestic violence in an attempt to sell shoes, for example, is not considered problematic, but rather controversial. Which is a huge difference as a foundation for discussion. What I mean is that it can be a challenge to have a relevant discussion in a world where the depiction of the threat of or actual sexual violence, for example, is just considered a brave communicational choice. So these sort of advertisements have actually changed for the better in the past years in my little opinion, but these obvious stereotypical representations are also quite easy to spot and unpack. Advertising is tightly connected to capitalism, but you know, so is design, but perhaps less obvious. And I thought of one of Sweden's most famous design heroes. Olle Excel is the author of Design Equal Economics, published in 1964. Considered a monumental piece in the Swedish design world. And the statement of that book is basically that good design literally pays off. So that also says a lot of our tradition and where we come from as designers.
Yeah. But what do you think needs to be done in order to switch the focus from capitalism and advertising to a more sustainable one, where you include power relations, inequalities, and social change?
Dismantle capitalism and patriarchy.
Okay.
So basically just that.
Yeah.
No, I'm just kidding. But there, or am I? But there is a responsibility as a designer. And I stress that a lot. You have a responsibility. When you start creating communication and messages, if you're a designer, there's a responsibility. And even more so for educators to find more sustainable ways of working and communicating. And today, that is not a lot to ask for. Design can and should be a political and social practice.
I mean, many design schools seem to want to adapt to the ecological and social challenges of today. I see many programs and courses have either received the word sustainable in front of it, or the tail and social change. But it's not as easy as to rename courses to sustainable design or design and social change, is it? I mean, since the Bauhaus era, almost the whole purpose of design has been to create unsustainable modern styles of living. How do you just, you know, change that?
I guess you have to start somewhere, and my perception is that these educational scenes that I mentioned before, that are at the forefront of social change, for example, in my opinion. This is my very subjective like perception of this. And they're at the forefront of social change, and they're often platforms outside of academia. So there's also the reason why they can push different agendas, perhaps a bit. Yeah, but you get what I'm aiming for here. And there are definitely solid attempts at design programs at universities to push forward as well. They are definitely working for that at several universities that I know of in Sweden, which is the context where I teach. But again, that sort of change in culture, if it has not been present before, that requires a lot from the leadership of the university and the department, and not to mention the tutors.
Yeah, the tutors, very much so. Tobias Denskus, he writes that even the most modest attempt of decolonizing the academy, it requires a different mindset, that we need to reconsider the whole traditional ways of presenting material and a traditional role for those working in academia. There is so much diverse material, he says, from many different sources, that curation and facilitation will become more important skills in the future. Do you agree with that? Have your role changed? Are you more of a curator, facilitator nowadays?
You know what? I'm definitely working towards being that. I want to be that. I find that that approach is a very appropriate way to give everyone an equal learning experience, for example, and to find a more collaborative approach and curate resources as a starting point for research and work. So, and this is actually also an approach I tried to implement recently in a project in my own studies, also with the ambition to, I wouldn't say decolonize, but perhaps review alternate ways of presenting knowledge in an attempt to reallocate the power of certain narratives. But I don't know if I was very successful at it, to be honest, but at least I tried. At least it was an attempt to find another perspective to gaining knowledge. And I think maybe that is important to just dare and try and implement to get started and see where that leads you. And from what I understand, Konstfack in Stockholm works with the feminist pedagogy, which is something I'm currently myself just starting to understand and also to some degree implementing my own work, both as an educator and practitioner.
That sounds very interesting, and it really reminds me a lot of Paulo Freire and his concept of libertarian education, as opposed to the banking education, where you just, you know, deposit the knowledge. This is not only harmful in education, but also later in society, because these adaptable, manageable students, they accept this passive role, and they tend to simply adapt to the world as it is, not trying to, you know, change it at all. But then, you know, in the libertarian education, the student develops a critical consciousness and goes out in the world wanting to transform it. So maybe we have we found a key here in the curating, facilitating feminist libertarian pedagogy?
Yeah, and the teacher-student relationship is so interesting, and me, as a person who brings the scissors and paper, I would like to say, why shouldn't I cut and paste as well? But, you know, I definitely think this is an appropriate way forward in education, and perhaps also being in processes as a designer. And I really like this approach, and I'm trying to learn how to implement it more myself.
Yeah. Well, Tobe, we have to wrap this up. I'm very pleased with this discussion on how refiguring current design education and how that could lead to the creation of more responsible and sustainable design. The references, we made some references to some reading, and I will post that in my blog if you are interested of reading more. So let's just say thank you, Tobe.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.